21st, 22nd, whatever that weekend is. I'm assuming that, as with our past board meetings, will begin Friday night, go all day Saturday, most of Sunday. There may be some preliminary warm-up meetings leading into it. Again, not only will the board be there, but we invite people certainly from Houston and the Houston listening area, but people from around the country to be there as well. In the meantime, I also want to encourage people to listen, you know, people who haven't listened to the webcast or the broadcast, to let us know. It would be also great to, if when we all go back to our various listening areas, to see if we can find some people who perhaps didn't listen or listen for an hour, you know, and get their feedback also. I think it's very, very vital that these meetings be conducted in the most open way possible. At the same time, I do think we need to think about, you know, the broadcast, the webcast, how to do them, you know, in ways that are also interesting and good radio. So we do want your feedback on that. George, one more thing and that's it. You're on your own.
Are there
going to
be any public comments? No. Email feedback.
Okay, one second. George wants to say something. I'm sorry. George.
Will you please articulate what we, the consensus of this board, decision of this board was regarding bylaws?
We have to have them.
That time of night.
I'm sorry, George. I actually don't know that I could do that right this second. We will do that. We will clarify this.
Later.
I'm just at my wit's end here. You know, I just don't have any more energy to do that. If that's okay. Somebody asked in the back of the room, was be there more time for public comment? I have gotten this. First of all, some people have to catch planes. Others of us are just burnt. And it doesn't. I don't think it really helps you or us or anybody for you to talk to people who can't absorb what you're saying, right? If we're over the, and well, no, I don't believe the broadcast is going to go further than the meeting. So let me just see this. How many people? Excuse me.
Thank you.
Listen, thank you. I just want to see by a show of hands. Excuse me. I just want to see by a show of hands, how many people.
Why don't you show my maturity, sir?
I'm going to adjourn.
Hey, Ted, calm down. Ted, don't be.
But I'm going to move to adjourn.
You can turn this way for a second and ignore that. I just want to see by a show of hands how many people want to make a closing comment here. I just want to see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's it. Those five people who put their hands up. You got a minute each. How's that?
This is KPFA. Berkeley, KPFB, Berkeley, KFCF, Fresno, KPFK, Los Angeles, WBAI, New York. We'll definitely stay here till the conclusion of the broadcast and of the meeting. And also, please stay tuned on KPFA at least, and perhaps on the other stations for a wrap-up show.
I just want to, my minute, it Ray gave me a chance to, I just want to toss the issue of the bylaw that I thought was important to remind the board as well as the listeners and producers and the staff and everybody that I thought that it's an important thing in the bylaw, which is to define the relationship among all of us. That because I think some of the problem that happened here is the miscommunication in that relationship and that and how that's supposed to work. And I think that some people don't have a clear understanding of that. And I think that right now we have an opportunity through the bylaw not only to think that the power will be in there, but at the same time is relationship more than anything else. And finally, at the same time, not to forget that that's going to be a legal document, and we should make sure that there is no so many halls that give the people opportunity to start coming out with suit and things like that. And by that being said, I try to call the attention to the lawyer. Should be some kind of legal advice to the board in that sense.
Yes, yes.
That would be
my question. Thank you, Steve. And again, we just need
right. My name is Steve Brown. This is a great board, but you scared the hell out of me this morning. When you revealed that the executive director signed off on one of the most important contracts that Pacifica could make with Democracy Now for some $500,000 in 5 years, and nobody on the board had read it.
That's who was the person who did that.
You signed, okay, but the rest of the board did not read it or approve it.
That's right.
Okay, and I think that, not to say anything about Dan or anything else, that we ought to have in the bylaws a limit on the authority of the executive director, how much money he or she can allot, how much authority he can exert in different areas. Otherwise, we have a Bessie Wash thing where you run around doing weird things, committing the foundation to things that they can't undo, like sweetheart contracts and other things.
But I think your concern is extremely well taken. The example you give is totally off. That's all.
That's 50-50. Okay.
The issue you raise is important.
It's Mariah Gillardin, local advisory board member at KPFA, and banned for speaking too long in 1993. I hope it doesn't happen to me again. I want to thank you for giving the 2 hours of discussion. I'm very concerned about the intervention of the general managers of WBAI, of KPFK, and WPFW. I'm glad the other two stations didn't appear here. I'm afraid they might use the non-carry clauses in scuttling this process. I know they did say they were all in favor of it, but they just didn't want it legalized. If they were all in favor of it, how come we didn't have it yet? We should have had this process already for many months. In a few months, the listeners will have the fate of the organization in their hands, and you keep them willfully uninformed.
If I may say, I don't think they opposed it. They just were worried about the implementation.
Well, I don't want to use up the rest of my time. What we need in addition, 1 hour a week of reporting time that's shared between the general manager, the local advisory board, the program director, and you. We need to hear from you. I'm a lab member. I don't know what you're doing. I need to call one of you and get some information. But the process that you are using to change this organization is not transparent. The Democracy Now! Contract has huge problems. We don't know who else is getting paid off with large salaries. We need to disclose of the salaries. And the last part is one small comment on the hiring process that led to Dan. It's not discussing Dan's qualifications or not. It's the no you gave to Marty Derlin, because this no is a no to 8 years of activism she was involved in, as well as many of us. The no is a no to the Grassroots Radio Coalition, which she founded, which includes most of the affiliates that you're supposedly so concerned about. They feel really insulted by having one of their best members refused. And the last one, and maybe politically most hot, is Marty Derlin is a person who gave up her job with the NFCB when she was forced to abide by the Healthy Stations Project. She is the one who led the biggest resistance against the Healthy Stations Project that also destroyed Pacifica. So you know, to her, it's a large political no that's standing in the community and that you need to explain to us. And I wish you hadn't made this decision.
Next.
In the spirit of media democracy, I have 3 words, webcast, webcast, webcast. If there's an issue or a thing happening like Pacifica Now Conference, it should easily be available to everybody. We had to fight, work to Joel, put things together to get that webcast. In the future, I'm suggesting the board to make it easy.
The Pacifica Now?
Pacifica Now.
That was not a foundation activity, so just so you know that.
No, listener interested activities. What I'm saying is that to the whole audience, everybody at the board, all the station managers, those kind of things should be easy to be available to listeners. In other words, the webcast shouldn't be have to jump through hoops and jump through holder. We should have the support of the station managers and the board and all the listeners working together. It shouldn't be a struggle to share knowledge in regards to Pacifica.
Okay.
Thank you. James Hibbler.
Next time you should put up your hands when I ask for a show of hands. I'm going to let you speak now, but you are on the list. It's Dina, and then that's it. I'm sorry. I see other people lining up, but I asked for who wanted to speak, and I said that would be it. So it's this guy, because he made such an impossible fuss. We'll let him speak now so he doesn't make another one. And Dina, and that's it. I'm sorry. That's it. It's him and Dina, and that's it. That's it. Stan made a mistake. I'm correcting it. It's this guy I'm trying to catch your
That's
name.
Fine, Leslie. There's more generations of me to come. I'm going to be a big pain in the ass to Pacifica. I'm a former WBAI producer. I worked on Radio Bandung. It was one of the earliest casualties. It was one of the earliest casualties of the Pacifica campaign, you know, their five-year plan, getting rid of political dissent. I'm putting Pacifica on notice. They better give back Radio Bandung, their show, with back pay. And this was an unpaid staff position. So when I say back pay, I'm talking 5 years of airtime. You can either dole it out in 5 hours on a Saturday afternoon or all five stations. That would be nice because it was one of the most radical programs. Somori Marksman, who rest in peace, he was the linchpin of that, and he gets great accolades, but he was a Pacifica man that hatcheted the show. Noam Chomsky was going to be interviewed. Pacifica knew this. He was canceled. So you can roll your eyes, but I see this board as representing the same old thing. It's just new faces in the same old places. But you can go with it. I'll tell you what. In fact, we'll take a $400,000 a year contract to do Radio Bandung. All right, we'll take it, no problem. But I'm telling you, we're gonna get it back on WBAI, and I'm telling you,
I'm in defiance.
It will, Janice. You know what? The amount of radio time that you've done on BAI, it was, you know, in a half hour, Radio Bandung blew it away. I'm sorry, but that's gonna happen.
Can I say something, Leslie? On a serious note, by the way.
No, stop it.
No. Dina's next, folks.
Oh shit, lady, you don't even know the beginning of it.
Why
don't you show us some maturity?
Dina.
Really.
Okay, Dina is next. Dina.
He's civil.
Dina's next.
Be gone.
Hi.
Dina.
Oh, God.
This is Liz. Hello?
We're having a little equipment problems, but meanwhile, please stay tuned for the ongoing saga of the Pacifica board meeting.
Mariah, are you sure we're not as interesting? Okay.
Dina.
Let's talk about your car. It's screaming.
First, since I'm the last speaker, I'd like to thank both KPFA and the board for having the board meeting and doing an excellent job.
Our pleasure.
This was just a suggestion, a last one, that I will take responsibility for getting a few people from BAI to do some research with me on the possibility of one way of raising money for the national board would be to have a Pacifica credit card where whoever uses it, money would go towards the board. I will take responsibility if the board will allow me to research it and bring it back to the board as a possibility for fundraising.
Sure. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Any and all fundraising volunteers and suggestions are totally welcome.
The other suggestion, which I think is a positive one, would be that each listener station try and get frequent flyers for a minimum of 6 people of diverse background to come to each and every board meeting. That the host station make sure that they have housing and food. And at each board meeting, we would be bringing in 30 new people from a diverse background who would get more and more involved in the station and in the board. Over a period of a year, you would have several hundred people involved. So that's a suggestion for each station.
Okay. Thank you. And with that, I think
I just want to say a few words about the comments that were made about Dan Coffin's selection as a permanent executive director. I want to understand clearly that there was not a rejection of Marty or anybody else, that the board weighed very carefully some extremely competent, talented, experienced individuals, and with their potential contributions. And I mean, we all know, for example, that Dan Coffin is the only one who's been executive director of this institution, and that was not the only basis upon which we chose him. And I'm convinced that we have made the right decision. It is not the rejection of what Marty has to contribute, and it is just a decision that then had to offer the best package within this period of our history. And I'm convinced that the months that are in the coming months, it will be confirmed that indeed we have chosen the best candidate.
Move to adjourn.
I don't have to.
There's been several of the board members have asked for us to adjourn. I would like to do that. Right?
Yeah.
I think I can just adjourn the meeting.
Yeah. Thank you.
This meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
So the next meeting of the Interim Pacifica National Board will take place in September, I believe the third weekend of September in Houston, Texas. We do have a few thank yous before we turn it to a listener-produced radio program that brings us up to date and wraps up this Pacifica board meeting in a way that...
And you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Up now, a report of the evening's news with Barbara Day. Good evening. In the news tonight, we'll have reports on the Israeli takeover of Palestinian territory, a preview of tomorrow's hearings on the World Trade Center collapse, comment on the budget that passed the City Council, an update on the Central Park Jogger case, and plans for the June 29th FBI demo in Washington. With these and other stories, I'm Barbara Day, and this is the news for Sunday, June 23rd. 2002. The Israeli army is back in Jenin City. Today, in fact, according to latest reports from the region, the Israeli military is in every West Bank town, and the government says the army will stay indefinitely this time. Meanwhile, Palestinians living in West Bank towns and cities have been struggling to rebuild the infrastructure in those areas. The Israelis, for their part, are maintaining strict curfews, building walls around each town, and limiting travel outside of each given residential area. Today, according to the BBC, Israeli tanks and armored vehicles are rolling through neighborhoods and refugee camps, rounding up militants and maintaining a general state of siege. This afternoon, Sally O'Brien spoke with Saeed Arakat, Middle East analyst and commentator based in Washington, D.C.
The Israeli occupation has gone on for 35 years. It has been conducting itself brutally against the Palestinians with the same intensity, with different variations and different policies, but all in all, it is pretty much the same thing. Because Sharon is prominent with the Palestinian people. He wants them gone. He wants to transfer them. Because he envisions a greater Israel. He wants to divide the Palestinians into small inhabitant communities that are easily controlled, that are cogs in the wheel of the occupation. And that's what he wants to have done with that.
There was an urgent appeal that came out from the Union of Palestinian Medical Relief Committee in Nablus saying that the Israeli army is launching a massive military operation against Nablus City, including in its four refugee camps, and that for the fourth time in 3 months, Israeli troops have reinvaded the city and suburbs under the pretext of fighting terrorism. And they say now everybody is under a strict 24-hour military curfew. And what can you tell us about this?
People are not allowed in and out. the other day in Jenin, for instance, they lifted the siege for a couple hours, and the Israelis ended up shooting a whole family. They killed every member of that family because they said that the curfew was not over. So the same thing is happening in the city, the old city, and the whole city of Nablus, and the four refugee camps around it. They are disallowing the humanitarian groups from going in and out. No ambulances can go in. No food can get in. No water, clean or otherwise, can get in. And it is really a very urgent situation. There must be immediate interference by the international community, by the International Red Cross, by the UN, to make sure that this human suffering is alleviated and that the ambulances are at least allowed in to retrieve the wounded, that water is going in, that food is going in. Otherwise, we will end up with a catastrophe on our hands.
I understand that mass arrests are taking place. Is that in most of the towns?
At any given time, there are more than 8,000 to 10,000 Palestinians in a prison. And what they do, they arrest whole communities, but also a great many among its young and most productive people are in prison. So they reopened Ansar 2, which is a desert camp where the prisoners are kept.
And today, the Israeli cabinet approved a security fence along most of the line separating Israel and the West Bank. And they started work on this fence last week, saying for security reasons to keep, quote, Palestinian militants from carrying out suicide bombings. And how will this affect life for the Palestinians? What's the implications of this?
It will only exacerbate the suffering of the Palestinians. Look, already the Palestinians are divided into 13 cantons. And within these 13 cantons, it is divided into 280 communities, small, tiny communities of villages and towns where there is no communication with each other, no connections with each other. People cannot travel to see their families and to see their relatives and to go to work or to go to school or to go to hospitals and so on and to go about conducting their daily business. So the situation is almost catastrophic for the Palestinians. And having said this, though, the fence will not help the Israelis. The fence will only show the world that Israel intends to create a very brutal apartheid system. And ultimately, the Palestinians will pull coal to this fence, because as long as the occupation is there, they will continue to fight to end that occupation. Remember, these fences have taken place on land that was not occupied in 1967. In fact, it is taking place on land that is taken in 1967. But all in all, the Palestinians will continue to struggle, and I believe ultimately they will prevail.
Saeed Arakat writes for a Jerusalem-based Arabic language newspaper. He spoke with WBAI's Sally O'Brien. You're listening to the news on WBAI New York. The tragic events of September 11th have led to the creation of the Skyscraper Safety Campaign. The campaign is composed of parents, widows, relatives, and friends of firefighters and civilian World Trade Center victims. The organization, after much struggle, has succeeded in convincing the federal government to conduct a comprehensive investigation into the causes of the collapse of the World Trade Center. WBAI Sunday News spoke with Sally Regenhardt about the pressing need for such a campaign.
The main goal of it initially was to convince the federal government to have a comprehensive investigation into why the World Trade Center collapsed. As of today, this date, there still has been not one single investigation into the collapse of the World Trade Center. Keeping in mind, there have been 12 different investigations into the collapse of Enron and not one single one into why the World Trade Center collapsed.
Who would be responsible for that investigation?
Well, we petitioned the federal government. We actually petitioned everyone in New York City, from the mayor to the senators to everyone in New York City to start this investigation, but no one really heard our cry, so we focused on Washington, the president, the Congress, and one congressman from New York State, upstate, Sherwood Bullard, heard our cries. We've had two congressional hearings, and tomorrow I'm very happy to announce is the first opening meeting of the federal investigation into the collapse of the World Trade Center. It will be held tomorrow in New York City at the Eastside Marriott Hotel, 49th and Lexington Avenue. And I'm asking for everyone, certainly relatives of the victims of the World Trade Center, to come to this important meeting, and all people who are concerned about how this ever could have happened to us, to please come to the meeting.
You are talking about reform in the building codes. And
yes.
Well, tell me a little more about what you're asking.
Yes, our organization has several goals. Of course, the first one is to have a federal investigation. We have gotten that. It is about to commence starting tomorrow. We also have the goal to reform the building codes, not only in New York City, but across the country. You know, right now, the same substandard standards apply to a, for example, a 10-story building as to a 110-story building. So we need to strengthen and reform the building codes as far as the number of staircases in a building, as far as evacuation procedures, as far as the materials they're allowed to use in these buildings. You know, the World Trade Center, in the stairways of the World Trade Center, the walls were made of gypsum board so that when the plane hit the building, all the walls of the staircases collapsed, even if those poor people could have gotten out because of the substandard and the lack of the proper building codes, they were allowed to have the situation.
I noticed that you say we put the focus on safety rather than on greed.
Yes. By that we mean that, you know, when that World Trade Center was built, the focus was on maximizing the amount of rentable space. And when you do that, you have huge amounts of open floor space without partitions. That is deadly to people in a fire. So the more columns you have and beams and partitions of office space, it's safer because it can contain the fire. In the World Trade Center, all the considerations for safety were really thrown out the window. And really another focus on this, on my campaign for skyscraper safety, is, you know, the World Trade Center was built without legally having to comply with one single federal, state, or city building code or one single fire department code. I know this sounds outrageous. People are shocked and horrified when I say it, and they think that I'm mistaken, but unfortunately I'm not. You know, the Port Authority is its own, it's in its own world. It has its own powers. Those buildings did not have to conform to building codes or fire codes. Our organization is insisting that the rebuilding of the World Trade Center must have to comply with building and fire codes. As it stands right now, they don't have to. It's our goal, one of our goals of our organization, to force that change in the law.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell us?
I just wanted to say what I have found out about building codes and laws since this happened has been a shock to me. I thought that I could trust the system. I thought we could trust our government. I thought we could trust the system that's in place in the city of New York to certainly protect firefighters and people who live and work in buildings. And now that I see the system, which allows buildings of any height, any size to be built, the developers walk away and they leave it up to the firefighters and to the people to figure out how to survive in these buildings. The system has betrayed the people of this city. The system has to be changed.
Sally Reagan-Hart, founder and chairperson of the Campaign for Skyscraper Safety. She's also the mother of a firefighter who died September the 11th. For more information on the campaign, the web address is www.skyscrapersafety.org. Skyscraper Safety, that's all one word. Tomorrow's hearings are located at the Marriott Hotel at 49th and Lexington Avenue in Manhattan. Doors open at 8 p.m. 8 a.m., of course. I'm sorry. You're listening to the news on WBAI New York. In New York City last week, the Answer Coalition and Muslim groups across the country held a news conference to announce a national campaign to defend civil rights against the abuses fostered by the Bush administration. The coalition also announced a march on the FBI headquarters for Saturday, June 29th. WBAI News Director Jose Santiago attended the news conference and begins his report with remarks by former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark.
We have, in its functional effect, by the Bush administration, with the uses of the Department of Justice and John Ashcroft and Department of Defense and Donald Rumsfeld, a coup d'etat against the Constitution of the United States. And if we don't stand up quickly, it will become permanent.
Longtime civil rights activist and former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who was joined by Arab and Muslim organizations and anti-globalization activists, saying they expect as many as 100,000 protesters in Washington on June 29th. They accused the Bush administration of shredding constitutional guarantees at home and of waging a worldwide war against the poor under the guise of protecting the nation and the world from terrorism. Larry Holmes of the International Action Center, a member group of ANSWER, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism.
For the past week, Congress has been holding hearings on Homeland Security, Bush's new proposal for another agency. But we don't think that these hearings are dealing with the issues that most people are going to be concerned with as this drama plays itself out. And that is the question of whether we're talking about Homeland Security or the criminalization of dissent. We have reason to be very concerned and very worried that our civil liberties are under attack, and that what the government is doing, using 9/11 once again as an excuse, is to target communities, to target groups, to target those who would protest, who would criticize government policies both abroad and at home. We see the pattern emerging. First, we have the so-called USA Patriot Act, which is nothing less than an attempt to make racial profiling, religious profiling, profiling on the basis of immigration status, profiling on the basis of political views, to enshrine it into the law, which is against the law, and an assault on the Constitution. And as a consequence of all this, we've seen, we don't know how many people detained. The courts recently ruled that the INS didn't even have to release the names of those detained, whether it's in INS lockups or federal prisons or on military bases.
Military bases, as in the case of Jose Padilla, accused of conspiring to set off a so-called dirty bomb on U.S. soil and who is currently being detained as an enemy combatant without access to legal representation. Attorney Lynn Stewart, who faces federal charges related to her representation of imprisoned Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, was among those urging people to attend the June 29th march in Washington. Stewart, who will next be in court in late August in her own case, as she is convinced that without legal representation, Jose Padilla is being mistreated, possibly even tortured.
As we say in the law, circumstantial evidence. They have a young man that was held. He did not speak to a grand jury. He did not speak to the U.S. attorneys who questioned him. His lawyer at that point indicated to Judge Mukasey, who also was the judge in the Sheikh's case, that the young man was not going to talk. But yet our Secretary of Defense announces that we will hold him, this person the President has confirmed is a dangerous person, without telling us any facts whatsoever makes him so, except he's Latino and has been to jail. I guess that would confirm it for W there. But notwithstanding that, they announce that we will hold him until he talks. Now, to me, it doesn't take a tremendous leap of logic to understand that that means we will torture him. I'm not talking necessarily about water dripping on someone's head, but I would think sense deprivation, lock him in a room, too hot, too cold, play the GED games that the FBI was always fond of playing, even when COINTELPRO was the rule of the day. Get him to talk. Talk about what? We don't even know, but get him to talk. That says torture to me.
Aside from what the group feels are clear constitutional violations, they accuse the Bush administration of waging a public relations war, encouraging Americans to distrust, even fear, people of the Muslim faith. Professor Hani Y. Awadallah, president of the Arab American Civic Organization.
When the Attorney General of the United States says that, and I quote, Islam is a religion in which God requires you to send your son to die for him. Christianity is a faith in which God sends His Son to die for you. This is the man who is supposed to be upholding the law and to see to it that the civil liberties, the Constitution of the United States, which separates church from state, to be upheld, to be upheld. This man is stating that somehow that his religion is superior to some other American religions. And if you are not really a Christian, then you really don't belong, according to this government.
And, says former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, repression at home goes hand in hand with imperialist policies abroad.
While we struggle for our own civil liberties, we have to remember that our government is taking lives abroad by the thousands and thousands. The so-called war on terrorism is not a license to kill. It's a commitment to attack wherever you want to. And who are always proclaimed to be the terrorists, the old enemies, anyone who had independence, anyone who defied us, anyone who got in our way, anyone who had a significantly different idea, anyone who wouldn't cooperate with corporate wealth and U.S. military ambitions. We have to insist upon our civil liberties here so we can stop our government from this war on the poor. It's basically a war on the poor everywhere.
And again, the mass march in Washington for Palestinian rights and against the Bush administration's post-9/11 policies takes place Saturday, June 29th. The International Action Center will make available buses that will leave New York City early that morning. Keep listening to WBAI for bus information. Meanwhile, Attorney Lynn Stewart says it's imperative for all people of conscience to make their way to Washington on that day and make their voices heard.
Angela Davis said if they came for me in the morning, they'll be back for you tonight. And that is the way we are living now in America. We must protest. We must raise the people. We must be of the people. We must raise them from the slumber that allows them to believe that this Ashcroft, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld axis, this evil axis will somehow protect them, which we know, and they should learn it will not. The only thing that can protect us is to do justice in the world. For that reason, I'll be there on the 29th, and I hope that everyone within the sound of my voice will be there also. Washington, D.C. The people.
For WBAI News, I'm Jose Santiago.
This is the news on Pacifica Radio New York. Last Tuesday, after several bitter battles between the New York City Council and the mayor's office, a budget was passed. The sticking points between the council and the mayor were funding for schools and the city university. WBAI reporter Stephen Howard interviewed city council member Charles Barron about the budget.
The mayor was supposed to come with us and unite with us around a budget by June 5th. That didn't happen. We had to extend it because we didn't want to take all the money that he wanted to take out of the budget. The mayor was proposing in his preliminary budget and in his executive budget $358 million taken from the Board of Education, $12.8 million taken from CUNY, cut $26.8 million from senior citizens. He wanted to cut youth programs in the summer, libraries, $39 million, so that they would only be open 5 days a week and not 6 days a week. He proposed cuts to children's services that were unacceptable to us. He proposed cuts to various cultural programs, 15% cuts. We said no, 5%.
The New York City budget was approved last Tuesday with $400 million in proposed budget cuts being restored. This is what New York City Councilmember Charles Barron calls funding that will enhance the quality of life for all New Yorkers.
We told the mayor join us in calling for a commuter tax to be given to us, and that would have meant anywhere from $400 to $500 million, almost $500 million. Join us in a absentee landlord tax. And prior to that, we were saying join us in a stock transfer tax. Join us in a PIT surcharge, a progressive income tax. If we would have put that tax package together, there wouldn't have been hardly any bleeding. We would have been able to balance this $5 billion budget deficit without hurting so many people.
Councilmember Charles Barron represents the 42nd District, which covers East New York, Bronxville, East Flatbush, and parts of Canarsie in Brooklyn. For the WBAI Sunday News, I'm Stephen Howard.
And this is the news on Pacifica Radio New York. The notorious 13-year-old case of the Central Park jogger is in the news again. The police and Manhattan District Attorney's Office are currently investigating the confession made by a man convicted of murder and rape whose DNA is a match for the Central Park crime scene and who says he was solely responsible for the brutal attack that shocked the city. Meanwhile, six black and Latino Harlem teenagers whose DNA never matched that found at the scene crime were, after a highly sensational trial more than a decade ago, sent to prison. But this new confession has received very little media attention. Kerry Wise is one of the six young men who declared his innocence 13 years ago. WBAI Today spoke with Michael Tarif Salam Warren, a noted civil rights attorney who has joined the effort to seek justice in the case.
Well, I think that Kerry Wise is obvious. He has been in jail for 13 years. He has suffered the infirmities that anyone would suffer as a result of being incarcerated. But even beyond that, being incarcerated for a crime that he did not commit. And the reason he has been in for 13 years is because he has never, ever admitted to being involved in the crime that he was convicted of. The others, their lives have been affected in many different ways. Two of them are still in prison, the others, although they serve time and are out on the street now, there have been many, many problems that have afflicted them through their families. Two of the young men, I think they're, and I want to refer to them as children because they were children at the time that this happened. Their fathers are now deceased as a result of the emotional turmoil that was created in the family's structure as a result of these unfounded charges. And I think that what is significant here is that at the onset, there was an absolute assertion of not guilty, and I think that know that the prosecution case pretty much hinged on the coerced confessions of two of the individuals whose families in good faith allowed the detectives to speak with them, and once they spoke with them, they began to cross-examine them, and they abused them, and they took advantage of them in the worst way, resulting in clearly coerced confessions. What is more significant is that now, at this juncture, what we have is Matias Reyes, who has admitted that he was solely responsible for it, even though the media reports still refuse to acknowledge that he was solely responsible, but that is his assertion. But even beyond that, there is a DNA link, a sole DNA link to Matias Reyes, confirming his assertions that he was solely responsible for it. And of course, the crimes for which he's currently incarcerated, at least the murder and rape of the woman on the east side of Manhattan back in 1991, was only 2 years after this incident occurred.
The young men who went to jail for this crime, including Kerry Wise, who's still in there,
yes,
their DNA never matched. The semen never matched.
Their DNA never matched. There was no evidentiary nexus whatsoever, no evidentiary connection of any of these young men not only DNA, but there was no evidence whatsoever. There were no hair exemplars. There were no semen. There was no semen. There was no DNA blood. There was no skin tissue. There was no mud. It was muddy in the park that night. There was no mud. None of these items existed in terms of being a basis for connecting any of these young men to this offense. So I think that what we have here is a very compelling set of circumstances where we have an admission, we have a sole DNA connection to the person who made that admission, and we have stark contradictions in terms of the prosecution's case, which resulted in convictions. We have a coerced confession of two of those individuals, which had an impact on the jury, and we have no evidentiary nexus between any of these children.
Civil rights attorney Michael Warren. And finally, Senators Robert Torricelli, John Corzine of New Jersey, and Charles Schumer of New York said today a halt in the nation's passenger rail service will prove nightmarish for New York and New Jersey. Torricelli said the state's economic infrastructure is threatened. They're calling on President Bush to prevent a shutdown. Amtrak President David Gunn said last week he would begin shutting down the railroad Wednesday unless the agency gets financial help to close a $200 million budget gap. Amtrak's board plans to meet tomorrow at the request of Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta. He said yesterday the government wants to avoid a shutdown and would consider providing emergency help. Some of the news for Sunday, June 23, 2002. The news was produced and engineered by Sally O'Brien, Stephen Howard, and Tony Ryan. Please stay tuned for Equal Time for Free Thought with host Sarah Kay. For the WBAI Sunday News, I'm Barbara Day.
The Rent Guidelines Board will vote on rent adjustments for all rent-stabilized tenants.
On Wednesday, June 26th, tenants will testify at a public hearing on the need for rent decreases during this time of economic hardship.
While landlord profits from stabilized housing have increased dramatically, tenant income has not kept up with past rent increases, and homelessness is at an all-time high.
There are over 2.3 million rent-stabilized tenants in New York City. Let's make 2002 the year we use our collective strength to get rent justice.
Come make your voice heard on Wednesday, June 26th, 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. in the Great Hall at Cooper Union, 7 East 7th Street in Manhattan.
For more information, call the Metropolitan Council on Housing at 212-979-6238.
That's 212-979-6238. More floors, less sleep to the night, and pieces more warm. The cannons roar like cozy rainy season, thunderclap on the block where your old pops need a number at. To the spot where the will we be paid for the work we've done?
Operation Power, people organizing and working for empowerment and respect, sponsor a community forum on reparations. Speakers include Councilman Charles Barron, Attorney Roger Wareham, and Plaintiff Deidrea Farmer Pellman, who will lay out the plan to demand from the United States government reparations due people of African ancestry. What are reparations? Does the United States government owe people of African descent for slavery? What happened to 40 acres and a mule? The forum will take place on Monday, June 24th at 6 p.m. at Intermediate School 263, located at 210 Chester Street between Blake and Sutter in Brooklyn. For information, call 718-649-9495. That's 718-649-9495.
My thoughts freely flower.
Die Gedanken sind frei.
My thoughts give me power.
No scholar can map them.
No hunter can trap them. No person can deny. Die Gedanken sind frei. No person can deny. time of treasure.
Welcome, everyone, to Equal Time for Free Thought, a new program here on WBAI 99.5 FM. If you've tuned in looking for Out FM, hosted by Merle Becker, that show has been moved to Mondays at 11 a.m., but we hope you'll stay with us anyway and come back to join us every Sunday at 6:30 p.m. My name is Sarah Kay. I'm your host and producer for ETFF, otherwise known as Equal Time for Free Thought, and I'm joined here in the studio with several other members of the Free Thought radio team, whom you'll hear from shortly. Now, this program is sort of carrying on the tradition started by Samori Marksman. WBAI was one of the first programs ever to have Free Thought programming, and it was thanks to Samori that it got off the ground and flourished for quite some years. Now, this is our first current show, so I'd like to read you our mission statement to give you an idea of what we're about. Joining me will be Pat Colucci at this point. The question is, what is free thought? This is a term used to encompass several ways of thinking or living that are, in essence, non-religious. Free thinkers would include atheists, agnostics, skeptics, rationalists, and humanists of several varieties. Many in the free thought community are committed to human rights and an ethical moral life stance that is secular, not relying on religious dogmas or deities. And many are committed to a free thought of scientific naturalism and free inquiry into supernatural claims. These views and approaches to life are shared by a sizable and growing minority of Americans, but are largely excluded from the mainstream corporate media. Equal time is sorely needed.
Just as WBAI stands in a proud tradition of progressive dissent from the mainstream corporate political system, this show stands in dissent from the mainstream society, which is dominated today by supernaturalism and religious or faith-based views. In fact, many of us believe that a vital part of achieving social progress will be freeing humanity from superstition and supernatural beliefs. We plan in this show to explore and represent the richly varied concerns of the free thought community here in the New York City area and beyond.
And now I'd like to introduce Barry Seidman, who will share with us some relevant news items. Barry?
Good evening. Thanks, Sarah. Reported this past Monday in the Washington Post, Colin Lynch writes that conservative U.S. Christian organizations have joined forces with Islamic governments to halt the expansion of sexual and political protections and rights for gays, women, and children at United Nations conferences. The new alliance, which coalesced during the past year, has received a major boost from the Bush administration, which appointed anti-abortion activists to key positions on U.S. delegations to U.N. conferences on global economic and social policy. The administration has led the coalition in blocking an effort by European and Latin American countries to include a reference to the final declaration to reproductive health care services, a term conservatives believe could be used to promote abortion. This alliance showed the depth of perversity of the U.S. position, said Adrian Germain, president of the International Women's Health Coalition. On the one hand, we're presumably blaming Islamic countries for unspeakable acts of terrorism, and at the same time, we are allying ourselves with them in the oppression of women. From BBC News last month, Kim Kataz reports that more Iraqis are going to the mosque and more Iraqi women are wearing the veil. This is an unusual phenomenon in a country that has always been staunchly secular and is ruled by the secular Ba'ath Party. But for Iraqis struggling with life after two wars and 12 years of sanctions, religion is slowly becoming a refuge. The growing religious mood was first perceived as a threat by the Iraqi regime, but instead of stopping it, the regime co-opted it, and religious fundamentalism is now tolerated. Still, Iraqi society seems to remain secular at heart. Iraqi artists renowned in the region are still painting nude bodies, which is unheard of in other Muslim countries. At home, people still enjoy a drink or two if they can afford it, and although the number of veiled women is growing, it is still less common than even in Jordan or Egypt. In the last month's New Scientist magazine, it is reported that scientists have noted that a religious upbringing may contribute to obsessive compulsive disorder. Patients with OCD get caught up in vicious mental cycles that can take over and cripple their everyday lives. For instance, a sufferer may become convinced that everything around them is dirty, and in extreme cases spend up to 8 hours a day cleaning in a bid to banish the thought. The researchers compared people, such as nuns and priests who worked in the church, with committed lay Catholics and others with virtually no religious involvement. Each subject was asked to document mild OCD symptoms, such as intrusive mental images or worries. The more devout Catholics reported more severe symptoms. A few weeks ago, in the Washington Post, reporter Michael Fletcher wrote about two House Republicans who are pressing for the adoption of a school science curriculum in their home state of Ohio that includes the teaching of an alternative to evolution. The representatives urged the Ohio Board of Education to consider the language in a conference report that accompanied the major education law enacted earlier this year. That language was crafted with the help of a leading proponent of intelligent design theory, which contends that the very complexity of life is evidence that the world was organized by a guiding intelligence. Science and education groups, however, most of whom back teaching only evolution in biology classes, call the language part of a wider campaign to force intelligent design theory into the nation's science classrooms. Their concern is that the congressional language will be used to challenge the teachings of evolution across the country. And finally, Matthew Nisbet, writing in last month's American Prospect magazine, reported about a recent survey by the National Science Board, which found that 30% of respondents professed a belief that alien spacecraft from another planet have visited Earth. How does such a sizable minority of Americans fall under the spell of extraterrestrials? The answer, Nisbet found, lies in the giant storytelling mill of the mass media, from the X-Files to newspapers, unskeptical articles, a belief factory that discovered alien tales to be a veritable goldmine. Along with the belief in ETs exists a new age trend, Talking to the Dead, featuring such showmen like best-selling author James Von Prague and Sci-Fi Channel performer John Edward, whose show Crossing Over is very popular. In a recent Time magazine article, science writer Leon Jaroff suggested two explanations for Edward's apparent psychic success. The old fortune teller's technique of cold reading, which involves a succession of quick generalizations meant to elicit a response from individual audience members, followed by a series of educated guesses based on demographics, and then hot reading, a variation on cold reading in which the medium takes advantage of information serendipitously gathered in advance. And that's the news for today.
Thanks, Barry.
We have our music, right? We got Norm Allen. We're going to get him on the phone now.
Barry. Next, we have an interview with a leader of the current free thought movement, Norm Allen. Norm Allen is a senior editor of Free Inquiry magazine, the flagship publication of CSI.